Okay, so it's 6 o'clock, and we said we were going to end, but I'm going to invite the speakers from this afternoon to come to the front of the room and field questions for those of you that are interested in asking them some questions. So if I could get the afternoon speakers to the front. Okay. Yes, sir. Question for Todd.
Yes.
Is it possible to get any of the slides that you showed?
Yes.
I educate a lot of student organizations about the
You wanted to make the PowerPoints available, right?
Yes.
So I'm just going to give them to Nora. And then,
just put them on your site, and then
we'll get them up.
We'll get it. If you want to make sure, just get a card from me.
I'll get it from Nora, but I'll give you my card too.
Okay.
I wonder if you personally think that Florida will ever have an aquifer protection.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's going to take lobbying, but I think that there are people actively lobbying for that now. The people I work with in the Florida Geological Survey try to lobby for it. We're trying to lobby for what we call a concept of an observatory. Probably some of the science people in the audience probably are familiar with it, but the idea is to have a designated, basically to think of a karst aquifer as a process to study, instead of like it being different, fundamentally different at every place you go. You would think of it as, well, this is a different set of physics maybe that we need to explore and be able to articulate better than the porous media theory. So what you do is you set up an observatory where you instrument, you know, a particular area very heavily so that people can come and study it, not just us, but anybody can come and conduct studies and avail themselves of a network of instrumentation so they can learn from that. And ultimately, then, the idea would be to compile that data into, you know, methodologies that then would become, instead of they would replace the other methodologies as the ones that are required to be performed on karst studies. And right now, the FGS we're part of the study that we're doing in the Wakulla Basin, where they have evaluated different geophysical methods to identify which ones are the best at identifying conduit zones. We're looking at tracer test methodologies. We're looking at different downhole type of data, different tools that could collect that. We're putting it all online as well. So the telemetry system that the one talk was about, you can go online now and get access to hydraulic meters that we have installed, I think 25 of them all throughout the basin. You can get data on that. So there's a growing consensus that people need to talk to each other more often and need to share data, need to make the data, you know, more widely accessible. So yeah, I think there will be someday.
Thank you.
Mr. Chen.
I have a question for the modeling. It's difficult for the 3D class of model. I was wondering what the horizontal K kind of thing you're using and what the vertical kind of thing you assign to the non-K-weight system, the cell. And the second question, do you apply all the springs to that? Because I know you're assuming you have 15 sinks and the 4 assumed sinks. So do you assign those as springs as well?
I don't know how detailed everybody wants me to answer your question, but the short answer, or I guess the real answer, is that we're using a hybrid model. So The conduits are defined as discrete elements embedded in a finite element mesh. So the discrete elements have flow that is described as a surface with a, like a surface water pipe flow equation. So the key variables there are the Manning. That's why I don't know if it's a good idea to keep going with this. Maybe we could just talk afterwards. But
that might be a good idea.
But the anyway, it's a discrete medium. And then the second question is in terms of the springs and the Swalettes. What we do is we we design systems to accommodate the observed max. So basically the assumption that we're using is that if you know that there's a Swalette and you can observe that this Swalette takes a certain amount of water, if you can measure or estimate the amount of water that it takes, then you know that the conduit system that connects that Swalette to whatever discharge point it, you know, ultimately it connects to has to be able to accommodate at least the amount of flow that has been observed going down the Swalette. So in the case that the two cases that we're working, we're lucky in that we have a fair bit of dye tracing that has been conducted, and then we also have cave maps in the case of the Wakulla Basin. So we can, in many cases, feel confident that we've connected springs or Swalettes with the springs that they connect to. And then each one of those conduits has to be able to convey the maximum amount of observed water. And once it does that, then what basically what happens is that in cases where there's not that amount of water flowing in, they become in local sinks to groundwater flow. So groundwater doesn't, if you think of it, groundwater no longer converges on the spring points. It converges on the upgradient most end of the conduits that connect to the springs. And the Swalettes can reverse depending on how you set it up. And then, and again, we talked about that.
Yes, sir.
I have a question for Nancy.
Yes, sir.
Bill, I know you've gone through the peer review process probably more than 100 times. I know you're familiar with the permitting process for, say, phosphate mines. And it seems to me that there's a paradigm there where an agency is stretched too thin. It also happens to be the permitting agency is reviewing the application. They're often published with an institute, a food institute, that is again dependent on the industry for funding. Do you think that maybe the review process could be opened up and these people can be told if you respect the science and publish it and get fair and open peer review, and maybe we wouldn't be in court fighting over who said what? Is that an option, do you think?
Well, that's a noble idea, and maybe in the best of all possible worlds it might work. Somebody said, I forget who it was, that it's all politics, and that we need better rules. But actually, when you look at the way many of the regulations are written, they're fine. It's the way that they are interpreted, or rather misinterpreted, by, you know, politically motivated people at all levels. So what we need is a means by which people within DEP can, you know, work rationally, interpret things in an analytical manner, and not be squelched, you know, for, you know, making any kind of reasonable assumption and conclusions from something. That's the problem. So we have a problem. The problem is that the DEP is an entirely politicized organization. The water districts are the same. No one will ever work for those organizations like myself, who speaks freely, because you wouldn't last 5 minutes. You know, so that's the basis of the problem. So the only solution is to hire politicians to do what you want. Yeah, is to vote for people, you know, who have a different opinion about honesty and whatever. If such a person, you know, I think we have a few running for office in Charlotte this year. Hopefully, in your counties, you can, maybe some of you would run for office. I think that's what has to be done.
I have one question that's more just trying to clarify that I understand something that Dr. Back has just talked about. It seems like a simple slide that intrigued me. It was that picture of the cube filled with rock and water. And so you take out the rock. So first you figure out, before you do that, you figure out, like you said, 20% water, it's 80% rock. Take out 80%, take out all the rock. And now you've got an open pit that's going to eventually fill with water. So you can compute more or less in advance how much water is going to end up in there. but you can't exactly figure out what it's going to do in surrounding areas because there's different head pressures. Is that so? It's like the water table is not exactly a table. It's not level because there's different levels and there's different pressures.
Right.
So some of the water is up here and some is down there and it's creating head pressure and whatnot. So that is, I have another question, but that's
where yes, that's true. And of course, I don't, you know, there are a lot of people out there who are very capable of attempting to quantify, you know, those types of things. And I have very limited time, and I don't waste my time on those kinds of things. But what I have noticed is that in the sites that I've, and by the way, I've gone back to the area that Todd's company has been working in, the Woodville Karst Plain, and I went around and did ground truthing in the areas that he has identified these conduit systems. And probably not too ironically, those areas also appear to be having environmental impacts, which, you know, again, I think it's difficult with I guess it goes back to Peggy Schmidt's comment about, you know, the model you're using. Everybody is using this model of it's going to be a concentric circle or a set of concentric circles around the mine, and you look at those little concentric circles, and that's the only place you look. And you may not be seeing the impacts there. The impacts may be hop, skipping, and jumping through these conduits all over creation. And so that makes it extremely problematic to say, okay, so how far out? And you know, a lot of these people are...
The amount of water that's coming in there, that's just mathematics.
Right. You can probably calculate the amount of water coming in, but you don't know where it's coming from. So what I have noticed, though, is that you can make some inferences, like from the groundwater, general groundwater flow patterns, what we saw at the Schmitz property and what we've seen at the sites, what I've seen at the sites in Woodville Karst Plain and some other sites is the downstream flow area where the water would have been flowing through this area that's now a pit and down. That seems to be the most dramatic impacts. Not that they're not happening, to the either side or to the upstream area, but the most catastrophic impacts in the small number that I've looked at have been in the downstream flow.
Can I get one question for the gentleman from USGS? Because in the new front, people have been talking about that Lake Belt district being closed off because of Judge Hobler's ruling. And now the front has gone to the EAA, the Everglades Agricultural Area, just south of Lake Okeechobee. And we seem to be being told quite a bit by Palm Beach County and by other people that the limestone in that area is impermeable. It doesn't move. The water doesn't move through there. It's okay to mine it. Do you have any knowledge of the composition of that particular limestone in that area?
I personally haven't done any research in there, but the phrase limestone impermeable doesn't make any sense to me.
There are people throwing that around right now that it's okay, we can take the limestone out, it's not going to connect to the, it's not going to do any of the stuff that Dr. Backus was just talking about. It's not going to affect the Lafosse system, the Everglades, you know, it's going to be just a perfect fit that we can do what we want with it.
There's been plenty of studies done in Southeast Florida on the permeability of the limestone. I'm sure it's well documented. I can't imagine someone trying to defend that.
Yeah, but there are two different kinds of limestone. There's the old Key Largo Carl platform, and then there's Bryozoan. Once you start going to the west, you get to Bryozoan layer, and it could very well be that that's different in permeability. Maybe you know about that.
I would kind of pretend.
Well, it certainly is not the same.
This, by the way, there's going to be lawsuits around this for sure.
Impermeable.
I was at the 7 Mile Loop once, you know, and following this natural surrounding, he was describing how this was all Carl. I said, well, no, it's not. It's all Bryozoans on the surface. Now, I don't know what's down underneath.
And they said, picky.
And the Swiss cheese or anything.
Opinion, though, is impervious limestone is an oxymoron.
Right. Okay. Like you said, there's different levels of permeability, but it's limestone. It is going to react to carbonic acid. You are going to have permeability.
Some research that says less permeable than limestone, and they're saying going from nope. less permeable to not permeable.
Well, it, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the less permeable the limestone is, and they're talking about, I think when they call it permeable, they're talking about they've yanked a sample out or they've done a field pump test to check permeability. But, you know, when it doesn't have that level of permeability, then, if I understand correctly, then it's much more susceptible to fracturing. Is that not the case? And that then they're disregarding the fact that there may be fractures all over in there.
Well, permeability, and I'm sure you add more to this than I can, but it's the connectivity of the pores, of the openings within the limestone. And maybe that's their argument, is you don't have as much connectivity in these pore spaces. Now, that's permeability is a diagenetic feature. It's going to occur after burial. So the actual rock itself, you know, you can't say that it's not going to be permeable.
Well, I guess just to comment on that,
the limestone, I mean, there's heterogeneity, meaning that it's not the same everywhere. That's what I was trying to show in most of the assumptions. Fundamentally, they are saying that it is basically the same everywhere, or the same everywhere enough to make it so that we can assume that it's the same as their study. So, but in reality, you know, permeability is controlled by the lithology, what kind of rock it was, and how was it deposited? Was it a coral reef, like with, you know, all the corals, or was it a lime mud so that it's, you know, very dense? And then you have fracturing on top of that, and limestones, I mean, we see that there are fractures fairly ubiquitous, you know, in the limestones, not only in Florida. There's rocks tend to get fractured due to pressure reliefs and changes associated with all kind of other geologic forces, so it's not uncommon to find fractures. And then, however, the permeability is established, once you put a flow system through it, then it's going to dissolve because it's soluble limestone. So then you have different preferential flow pathways that evolve through the lime rock over time. What I think people try to do is they try to, again, force a preconceived idea onto, you know, well, it must be this way because, you know, this is how I believe it to be. And the data doesn't necessarily support that, especially, for instance, when you, like the pink, that's why I put the pink underwear test up there, is that most certainly, I'm not trying to say that the same kind of caves in North Florida exist in South Florida, so you can't scooter through them. They're not big giant tubes that go to big giant springs, but they're, you know, if you have a conduit the size of a thumb that connects, you know, through the matrix, then that has a big control on flow pathways. And those, again, it's simple. You put water through it, and the medium is soluble, so you're going to dissolve force pieces.
Rhonda will get the last question, perhaps.
Well, actually, I have three.
Oh, pick your best one.
Well,
yeah.
No, I get that mining is a serious impact on the groundwater. We have corrupt politicians. My background is DSG. I listened to what Bill Dunstan has seen 1,000 times on junk science being forced on the public, sort of head bad projects. Is there a way that you can imagine that we can? That's a two-part question. Are there bigger impacts to these beloved rivers and springs in North Florida than really have to worry about? One, two, we're going to have hard work. We've got corrupt politicians, we've got development projects all over, we have DOT contracts. How do we protect the natural resources from those ones? And the other question is, what's the impact of increasing CO2 levels in the atmosphere on our
cars? Okay, so I think we had three questions. Maybe we'll be able to field two of them. Are there impacts other than mining that we need to be paying attention to, or is mining the number one priority? What was the second one? Oh, how do we navigate the system and improve it? Obviously, we're not going to stop mining. What can we do to affect most positively the most sustainable, least impacting strategy to use the natural resources in a way that we're going to have grandchildren enjoy in Florida as well? And I think it's another conference to go to climate change and carbon dioxide. Okay, so is there an impact larger than mining that we need to worry about in Florida, North Florida Springs? And keep it close to your mouth.
I'd like to start out by saying, in all of the impacts that I have evaluated over my lifespan, which stretches back into the 70s, I have not seen anything that has as catastrophic as impact to the environment as mining. And I find myself on the other side of the fence from Nora, in that I believe that there are alternatives to mining and that we don't have to mine. And, you know, I think Peg was suggesting that we need to start thinking out of the box and we need to start thinking of alternatives. There's one back there right now, grind up glass. You know, if they want aggregates and they want sand, get a gigantic glass recycling plant going in South Florida and start recycling all your glass. I mean, certainly there are tons of alternatives out there. I'd like to see rubberized plastic substituted for the concrete sidewalks that I just took a crashed landing into when I tripped after my surgery last week. I think, you know, rubber, it curves. I mean, you know, the concrete cracks, they have to replace it. Put up rubberized curves. I mean, seriously.
Well, I don't know if I want to follow that.
Go ahead.
I would say that I tend to look at things in terms of point source, non-point source, and then somebody used the chronic and acute, and so and I think they kind of cross over. But from my perspective, non-point source problems tend to be the worst because they pervade the environment. So, for instance, a reason I'm here is because I love springs. I started scuba diving in springs when I was 11 and have been doing it ever since. And in less than 15 years, we've seen a catastrophic decline in water quality. Almost all of Florida springs have seen that. And that's, to the best of knowledge, largely due to non-point sources of pollution to the springs. And then on top of that, you have quantity demands. So as more and more population comes in, you start extracting more and more water from the ground, despite what the management districts think that, you know, we just keep doing this forever and ever and ever. It, you know, you can't absorb that exponential increase in demand. What will suffer is the quantity of flow to the springs. And unfortunately, as you reduce the quantity, if you maintain the same chemical input and reduce the quantity, then the concentration goes up and you're mutually exacerbating the problem. So, yeah, I think that there are worse problems, but I think that the solution to the problems is the same in that they are political, in that what has to happen is we have to demand from the state a more comprehensive approach to characterizing our natural resources and, you know, a more responsible way of taking care of the problem. So, I mean, you know, we could be this, I've been in conferences when this is about non-point sources of pollution, and people are all up in arms, you're like, okay, well, you know, are we going to get rid of agriculture in the state of Florida? And you know, that's probably not going to happen, and probably wouldn't be a good idea to happen either. But, you know, what we need to do is make it so that agricultural impacts are reduced, and that is going to drive up costs. It's going to drive up costs on the agricultural producers, or it's going to drive up costs for you as a taxpayer, one way or the other. And that is a political choice. It's not I can't solve that with science. The science is not really all that, in my opinion, not really all that hard. You know, just take it out. So.
No, I have
one very, very quick thing. I think that on this particular coast, our biggest problem is nitrogen pollution, maybe with a little phosphorus thrown in, which is coming from human waste, some agricultural waste. That's way, way bigger than anything else because that's causing red tide, which is our single biggest problem, as well as this red drift algae thing that you're throwing in.
I have one quick question for our USGS representative here.
And my question is,
so she can ask them pass them back around.
My question is, when you were showing your, you know, you worked a scale down, you were showing your small boat towing the seismic and the, was it a canal or was it a stream?
That's a canal. Yeah.
Canal. So my question is, you saw the size of Horse Creek and you've got this meandering system. Does that pose any problems, that size of the system and that meandering nature that couldn't be overcome for your seismic use? And then the other comment I was going to make very quickly was, for those of you who saw that that video presentation on the wireless monitoring network system, you know, that's readily available. And that's what you should be requiring at the local level as far as monitoring, you know, for any of these permits that are being considered. You know, background level, a minimum of a year using this you know, constant data access as opposed to run out, you know, once a month or once four times a year and take a sample, worthless.
Doing seismic profiling in streams is very difficult. You really need to know what you're doing because it's shallow typically. The sound doesn't attenuate very readily because it doesn't have enough time to set up before it hits the bottom. You're turning, your sound source and your hydrophones are getting closer apart and further apart. So there's a lot of things that you need to factor in when you do these kind of surveys. And it also, the size of the stream restricts the opportunity to conduct grid surveys, which provides so much more information.
So some of the land profiling might work better?
Yes, land profiling, especially around these mines, apparently there's a lot of drawdown, and you have a lot of aerial surface that you need to cover. I would recommend doing aquatic marine surveys first, because wherever the water bodies are, canals, rivers, lakes, streams around it, and then follow up with land-based survey. And to answer the question about the CO2, it should increase dissolution, but I think that the impact from that is going to be far eclipsed by drawdown. So I got to go with aquifer drawdown as one of the biggest impacts.
Thank you.
Okay. On your way out, once you are done getting networking information done, if you could put your name tag back in the box out there, we'll use them for another day. It's been quite an adventure. We're obviously just a cog in the wheel, and hopefully it's a wheel that's going to keep turning and make improvements for the future. So if there's anything for the good of the order before we call this party done, I thank you all for coming. Bill.
Yeah, that's
exactly what I wanted to make sure that we worked
out the direction that you just
did. Thank you.
Good job. Thank you guys so much. I know you're sacrificing.
Mr. USGS, can I get to pick a match for with the Sierra Club of Broward County? Can I get one of your cards?
I left my computer on if you can get yours on to that one before we go.
Oh, here. Hi.
Yeah. Huh? The water's still turbid.
It's ED for you. So I'll do that. And are you going to be here for...
Yeah, I've got to clear a few things.
Okay, I'll get that for you.
Zero.
the proposal. And this is the utility site. Here's the line. And this is the utility site. So have you worked with
that? And you want to answer right now. In my opinion, the best place is smack dab in the middle of the line. Because you're going to be losing all that water anyway, and you may as well just be sucking it out as fast as you can into that supply.
That's right.
I would stick all 17 right into the mine. And suck the water right out of the mine.
I was wondering if they last.
That's what I advocate. Basically, what tends to happen is that, each tool has a different set of capabilities, and one that people really like to use a lot of times doesn't have, you know, all the capabilities. But the model we use, there's a model Modulo, and it can be used to reduce the overall way you can do. It's more about how the model is set up. It's almost like it's not the, you know, in like NASCAR, right? You know, it's the driver more than the car, and it's not like the same way, you know. And so if you get somebody that's incredibly mathematical, but they have no basis, you know, no good strong basis in hydrogeology, they're not going to go out and look for all the things that should be plugged into the model that are ultimately going to make it really good. And that is really the crux that I've focused on. So I don't use a model of B-plus, you can use Modulo. It's really about getting the hydrogeologist that is insightful enough to have to step away from the problem just far enough to be able to say that, wow, well, there's these springs over here, and I know that if I build a model and I don't include those springs, my model's not going to be right. And even if I'm trying to assess something that's happening here, you can't just put a little box around that on a model. You've got to put it into the bigger picture. That's really the good crux. And there are people out there that do that.
Okay, so in other words, whatever check was supposed to go to him, you
don't have to. This is my subject information.
Okay, yeah.
Our slides and stuff.
Sure.
I'll try to get it ignored, too.
All right.
And I have some questions about Palm Beach County. I've been librarian here for 5 years. I was the first one she called me.
Karen, you can get those checks around.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
She called me that. She said she
was
That's
how long it took to get there.
But the question I have about Palm Beach County is we're trying to find the smoking gun between the injection wells and the nobody does dietrich studies since it comes out of the ocean.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that if there's capabilities for anybody to do that. A lot of the wells are like 1,000 feet deep and they're 1,000 feet from the ocean.
Right.
There's one in Brevard County that's only about 200 feet. But that's 1,000 feet from the
ocean. Sure.
So
the problem with that, I talked to Brian LaPointe.
I know Brian.
Yeah. We've talked about this several times, and really the problem is that what you want to be able to inject something in a well, and then you want to be able to detect it in the ocean. And the problem there is that you've got to be able to
know where to stand.
Yeah, and when.
Yeah.
And it's a big ocean, so to speak. So when, let's say that your tracer comes out, it's going to immediately dilute with a tremendous volume of water. So
the Gulf Stream is right there.
Yeah, and the crux is then that you have to devise a sampling strategy that is going to be capable of detecting that. And that means you're probably going to have to use a lot of tracer, and you're probably going to have to set it up as what's called a continuous injection. So what we've done is inject a slug, and then
yeah, that was the other thing. The other thing is the cost. You know, I don't know what the range is.
What you would need to do for that is a continuous injection, which basically means that you just continuously put this trace water. The cost for the spray field study was about $65,000, something like that. And that was then we got an extension for sampling, so it was probably more like $100,000 of a sample.
Did you do that
for a year? No.
I wonder what the cost on that was.
That was USGS. That was a 10-time bill for it. Steve Krupa. I've met him. He's got like a really good guy.
Seat meters for water flow and stuff. And with Surf Rider Foundation, we've been collaborating with him at Sandaway House Nature Center in Delray Beach.
Right.
And it's right on the dune, 200 feet from the ocean, and they've got 200 foot wells in the surficial.
Right.
And that might be even better. Because it would come right out in the ocean, right in front of the...
I think, in reality, in order to do that ocean tracer study, it's going to be more of a program than a study. Because you're going to have to start by doing something like you just said, like a really close tracer test to work out a methodology. Like, what kind of tracer volumes are you going to need? What kind of tracer detectability are you going to have? What kind of sampling type of strategies and protocol are you going to be able to devise, execute, and afford? So that's really the crux.
The superficial only takes a week to go 5 miles from into the ocean.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah. He says the four inlets in Florida have like under the dune movement of the groundwater.
Yeah.
He said two or three magnitudes more than the water that goes out the inlets.
Think of it this way. This is what's confounding to me a little bit about the water problems is that, you know, how many years has it not been raining? Not really that long. I mean, Florida gets a lot of rain. And look at the severity of the drought that we're in. Well, it means that there's not a lot of storage in the aquifer. There's not a lot of long-term storage. It means that you turn off the rain and everything drains really quickly. It means that it flows really fast. So it doesn't. If water only flows like centimeters per day, then when you turned off the rain.
Yes.
We still have water for a long time.
My other question is, we've been trying to think of a way to do some sabotage, not sabotage, I guess you call it ecotage.
Yeah.
Where we've got a bill in the legislature to require the casino ships to pump out and not discharge in the ocean. And that's more pertinent someplace over here than it is in Palm Beach County where they're out in the Gulf Stream.
Right.
But, some of our members thought, well, let's just go on board, and they dump every night before they come back. Why don't we just go on board and put some diet on the drugs? But it would be at night.
Oh, well.
Is there any capability to rent a plane and maybe fly behind it for a few hours? And
fluorescent dye, buddy.
Is there?
Fluorescent dye.
What would it cost us to buy enough? Like,
it'd be more expensive for the plane.
Idea. Yeah.
Uranine, which is incredibly.
It's called uranine?
Uranine. It's acid.
When I need B vitamins, I think that does the same thing.
Yeah.
Uranine.
Well, it's in a lot of things. I mean, it's like, radiator
fluid,
green.
Okay.
That's basically a flavor of uranine.
We wouldn't want to dump that.
I think it's $30 a pound. And to do the trace that you want, you'd need.
They dump 10,000 gallons.
Doesn't matter. It's so fluorescent that, I mean, it's, like we injected, let's put it this way, I just injected a 5-gallon pail of urine for this last tracer test that we did in a sinkhole that is approximately 10 miles away from the Pella Springs. 5 gallons. We turn the spring green. The spring's discharging at about 200,000 gallons a day.
How long did that take?
It came through in 7 days.
Well, let's do the South Dave injection one. That's 200 million gallons a day. And it's going eastbound at 6,000 feet per day, according to in the Boulder Zone. But that would be out on the shelf, I guess.
Yeah, see, you know, I guess...
Or in the Bahamas.
You know, I guess you could look at it like, if it travels that fast, if it really did, maybe it would be worth the money just to throw it out there and see if you can visually detect it.
But if it goes
like,
down...
But if it goes 10,000 kilograms, you know?
But if it goes down the pipe...
Been looking for those. There's no definitive ones. None that you can tie definitively to the deep well injection. Yeah. Well, the point, and there's another guy...
You're saying no papers?
No natural tracers, he was saying. In other words, something that already exists in the water that you can just look for and fingerprint.
And I'm caffeine or something. Yeah. It's everywhere.
That's what LaPointe, and there's another guy, University of Miami, that was he got all kinds of trouble because he was saying that the Everglades problem,
they wrecked his office
problem.
And everything. I know his name as well. I know Brian's.
Man, talk about
what? That's a Carl Hyacinth book right there.
Yeah, totally. I mean, basically, these two guys in particular, I never met the guy from Miami, I've just read about him. But both of those guys are not isotope guys. Yep. Both of them are Lamont Dougherty,
chemistry. Nitrogen.
And they're looking for nitrogen isotope signatures to basically fingerprint,
right.
Like injection type water. And the problem is that they're not definitive
Larry
enough.
Brand.
They can't split it out.
That's Larry Brand.
Yeah, that's it. And they can't split it. They can't, you know, definitively split it from other things. But this guy in particular was doing a lot of research in Florida Bay. And he came out saying that he had data that showed that the Florida Bay problem was nitrate driven, not phosphorus driven. And the sugarcane industry did not want to hear that it's nitrate driven.
They've been hearing phosphorus for so many years.
Yeah, plus you can solve phosphorus a hell of a lot easier and cheaper than you can solve nitrate. It's expensive as hell to get nitrate out of
and
water.
And Billy Cossey, the sanctuary manager in the Keys, never talked about nitrogen. He was at a conference with Brian.
Yeah.
He mentioned the word nitrogen. He said, "I never thought I'd say it." But they, now they're talking nitrogen.
Well, the guy from Miami, man, he has funding in, he has office vandalized, sabotaged.
He's got tenure, and they can't hold it. But the board of directors of the University of Miami is the Fonzul family, and they
get his funding.
They trashed his office. They took everything except his centrifuge and stuff, and they took his office suite and gave him like a closet, and took his hard drive, wrecked his computer, and then the campus police said, "Well, that's a job for the Miami Police Department," and they said, "No, it's a campus police thing, and nobody would follow up on it or anything." And he's still working there, but he's just got no equipment and
history.
And he's still hanging in there, and now people are starting to listen to him. They're hiring him to do studies over here and stuff, and he gets published, but it's been a real struggle for poor Larry Brand.
So the problem, again, is like, you could always just, roll the dice, and if you could get somebody to come up with a few $1,000s,
But then you have to get somebody in South Bay to say, we'll mix it in with this 200 million gallons a day. How do you get it that way?
You just pull out the cap. Cap back fun.
It's that easy.
They'll say,
somebody pays for the crew.
It's not rocket science, buddy.
They shouldn't be worried because it's going in the boulders on. It's like 3,500 feet.
Yeah, it's confined.
And it's just going to scoot right eastbound, but who knows? Maybe it'll come back.
So my question if they say that it flows like that, then where does it go? It's got a discharge that has that kind of flow.
It's crazy.
Right.
It's cumulative. It does not equal.
Did you hear me earlier?
The water budget doesn't work.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
We calculated 3 cubic miles per year. So all the 300 injections, that's 3 cubic miles. So, and yet it's a mile high, three of those every year.
Deep well injection, it's hard for me to stay non-biased scientist when it comes to that program.
And then you got the 100-foot wells, there's 600 of them just in the Keys.
It's the most ridiculous thing ever.
ever heard of. What's the consequences of putting a deep injection well along with 500-foot raw water wells right next to a mine?
You mean water mining? Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Is this the rest pond thing?
No, this is Babcock. See this mine here? They want to put their utility site right there, right next to it. 200 feet.
Same as Rush Pond.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. Yeah, they want to do that and do raw water. They're going to have the deep injection. It's going to be 25,000 feet with a 3,000 borehole. Yeah, 2,500 with 3,000. You know, the final borehole is right, and then they're going to do 17,500 foot raw water.
Well, the only thing, is that from what I've seen of those things, the state has a wholly inadequate characterization requirement. So, like, for instance, I looked at the one for West Palm, and the documentation that I saw, which may not be all of it, but the documentation that I saw was that they installed two wells, one of them did not work out for them, they had to abandon it, and then they installed a second well, and they used what's called Packer tests. And I want to say they test individual zones in the aquifer as they go down, and they can pack them off so they can test them individually. And they characterize the permeability of those individual zones. And then based on those permeability tests at that one well, they concluded that the deep well injection was not going to have any impact on the Florida aquifer, which is, that's where it's complicated. It's all the Florida aquifer, theoretically. Basically, to me, that is, you know, I've done a lot of work on water resource problems in the West, where water is really, bad, and people really look at the quantity. And I don't see any difference between an injection well and an extraction. Hydraulically, you're doing the same thing, you're reducing pressure change. And then the aquifer is going to respond to that pressure change. In one case, you're going to create a mound of a lot, you know, you're going to put water in, increase pressure. The other one, you're going to take water out and decrease pressure. Either way, the task of the agency is to determine what the impact of the aquifer on that operation is going to be. And every place that I've seen where they want to do big stressors like that, they're required to do long-term stress tests at the operational capacity, equal or exceed the operational capacity that they're proposing.
So literally force the water.
Yeah, in other words, let's say that you're a municipality and you want to put in a well. And you want to put in this well to this aquifer, you want to pump water out of it, 1 million gallons a day. Then what the agency would do is they would say, okay, well, you have a demonstrate that 1 million gallons a day is sustainable, meaning that you're not going to overly impact the aquifer, cause it to go dry and have all these terrible consequences. So what the applicant would be forced to do is a stress test, where they would go and install their pumping well, and then they would install a series of monitoring wells around it, and then they would perform a test where they extract the water at 1 million gallons a day or more, usually like 1.5 million or even 2 million gallons a day. And then they would do that for like maybe at very frequent least they would do it for like 3 days. But in most cases, for big operations like that, they would make them do 2 weeks or maybe even a month. And then they would measure the change, the response in all monitoring wells. And from that, they could calculate or they, you know, believe they could get a handle on what the overall impact of that operation is going to be. In Florida Power and Light instance, all they did was characterize the permeability in that one well, and they said, you're good. And to me, that's holy. That's like malpractice.
And so there's
ridiculous.
No,
they should be required to put in a series of monitoring wells, both in the Boulder Zone and in the Florida and in the Superficial, and then they should be required to come up with
and running.
They're planning on injecting.
Maybe I should leave it for a while.
And inject it for at the rate they want to inject it or higher, for a period of time, like 2 weeks or a month, and they should look at responses in all those wells. If their theory, if their picture, their conceptual model is correct, they won't see any change in any of the head and the pressure of any of the surrounding wells. And then they'll go, oh, well, so it's all good. We'll be able to do this. But more realistically, they'll see big changes.
Having in mind right next to you. Like glass change and the effects that
wells or? No, I'm not going to say that it will or it won't. Blasting tends to create permeability. So I would think that it's probably not a great idea to do it.
How much does it propagate? I'm not the expert in that. I don't know.
The blasting effects in terms of how the range in which it actually is fracturing rock.
Yeah,
really, really.
Yeah,
I don't know how close they are, but in general, it doesn't propagate more than 10 feet, and that's it.
Okay,
it's actually breaking
rock. Sound Dave well. The deep well there, is only 2.5 miles of water line. He's actually.
Yeah.
But it's west of the injection well, about 2.5 miles. But we're wondering whether that could somehow pull from that pool. So I agree with you. This is the injection well. And then 2.5 miles west is the water line. It's actually a well field.
So tell me, what's your name again?
Jim's Story.
Jim's Story. Okay, so that would
be there you go.
Fantastic. We can do a tracing test.
It's really
a
one there and how everybody has a
This is the kind of test where we can do this very easily. This is so if you, in other words, you're just creating a scientific hypothesis.
Okay, so it's centralized.
You know, is it possible that water blasting? You know, like, what we would do is put an in-situ detection that measures fluorescence between
all
the wavelengths over areas, you know, just continuously.
Not necessarily.
I'm trying to get
money.
We have to do with the
successful.
No, I haven't
heard.
This is
I'm getting all
really, you're traveling to sit up and then after that.